is the Bearcast, presented by Bird Cultchen Ford. Bird Cultchen Ford has been in Waco since 1936. Ford is the number one selling truck in Texas 43 years running. The Bearcast is also presented by WellMed Medical Management and USMD Health System Dallas. Here's Craig Smoke and Grayson Grundhaver.
And welcome into the Bearcast on this Tuesday, March the 26th, 2024. Craig Smoke, joined as always by Grayson Grundhaver, Garrett Ross behind the scenes. And it is a March Madness Sweet 16 edition of the Bearcast, as we have good news and bad news when it comes to Baylor men's and women's basketball, respectively. Also, spring drills fully in now, over a week's worth of practices to kind of pick apart, or a week's time worth of practices, not a full seven practices already, but enough interviews and field time to go ahead and pick apart some of what we've heard and also talk about some of what we've seen. So we'll do that as well on the show today. Before we get started, if you're just joining us, so we are live Tuesdays at 11:15 on the Baylor Athletics on Sikkim 365 YouTube page. And if you would be so kind as to give us a follow and a like, we would certainly appreciate that. If you're already hooked up that way, then thank you for doing that beforehand, and also available after the fact on all your favorite podcast feeds. So with that squared away, let's get into it. Hoops to start off with here. And let's go good news or bad news first. What would you prefer, Grayson?
Let's start with the good news.
All right, good news is the Baylor women are in the Sweet 16 for the first time in Nikki Collins' tenure as head coach. And they are sitting now with a matchup against USC in terms of what they're looking at in advancing possibly to the Elite Eight. And that is a result of winning their first two tournament games, an 80-63 win over 12-seeded Vanderbilt in the first round last Friday in Portland, and then turning right around in the Northwest Rose City, because I'm from the real Rose City of Tyler, but Portland, I know, claims to be the Rose City. Not really the Northwest Rose City of Portland, but the regional there in Game 2 in Portland, 75-72. They beat Virginia Tech, and Jada Walker goes crazy for 28 points. So what a performance from her. But 2-0 in the tournament means you're in the Sweet 16. So congratulations to Nikki Collin and crew. Certainly not where they want to end things, but it is an accomplishment to reach your first Sweet 16 at the helm of the program. So what do you think? Number one seeded USC now up next for the Bears on Saturday at 4:30 p.m. on ESPN. But this is new territory, and it's pretty cool. And it's not new territory for the program in general, but it is for this staff. And man, I was fired up for the whole crew, but the Jada Walker game is, I think, how some Baylor fans will probably refer to what we saw against Virginia Tech the other night.
Yeah, and I wasn't expecting this. I just to be honest about it, Virginia Tech hadn't lost all year at home, and Baylor went in there, got the win. Obviously, it took a heroic effort from Jada Walker, 28 points, just a phenomenal performance, 9 of 10 from the free throw line. She was terrific, and I mean, this whole Baylor team really played well. They rallied behind each other, got things going, and in my eyes, this is just one of those kind of program-building type wins, I think, for Nikki Collin and company. And you know, we're going to talk about their matchup a little bit with USC. That's going to be a whole nother animal. But for them to get by a Virginia Tech team that was pretty dang good all year, I know Virginia Tech was missing one of their better big players. I understand that. But I think in general, Baylor took advantage of an opportunity. They went in, won at a place that's very hard to win at, and came out with a huge team win. So yeah, congratulations to them. This is phenomenal. Now get a real opportunity here in the Sweet 16 to make some noise.
Nikki Collin definitely had her fair share of fans pulling their hair at her riding the officials, but in the end, it was the right call, and it helped decide that game. Mm-hmm. And so you can, certainly have your opinion on, massaging the officials and kind of getting into their heads, but that's what you're supposed to do. Yeah. And guess what? they're in the Sweet 16 and Virginia Tech isn't. So what would you prefer? I know what I would. I would rather be in the Sweet 16, but I bring that up because I saw some of those comments initially, and that's just sour grapes and sore losers, which there's a lot of on Twitter and in all walks of life. But she brought it up as well in her interview with her yesterday and explained why she was writing the officials, explained just the ins and outs of that game, and got a lot more detailed with the entire first two rounds and where they are now and where they hope to be with USC now on the rise. And so if you haven't had a chance to listen to that, I definitely recommend you going over to the podcast feed for 365 Sports or over on Sikkim365.com, and you can hear Nikki Collin talk about all this in more detail. But, 75-72, Jada Walker, a huge performance, and that was also one of the things that we discussed, obviously, with Nikki Collin, was Jada Walker and how expected or unexpected was that, and just what were her thoughts on seeing a career performance like that. But, yeah, they were going crazy. The crowd was going nuts, chanting Jada, and 26 of the 28 points in the second half is pretty remarkable of a stat. So you win by three, and one of your players goes off for 26 in the second half alone. So fifth-seeded Baylor now into the Sweet 16, first time in 3 years, which covers all of Nikki Collin's tenure so far. And now the Trojans, Grayson. So what are your thoughts on this next matchup and a possible trip to the Elite Eight?
I mean, if you're going to pick one of the number one seeds to play, I do think that USC, or I think, you know, Texas might be the other one, but USC is a team that actually, I think Baylor actually fares okay against that. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say Baylor should be the favorite, but if you look at a lot of different metrics, USC is not that strong. They're more like a top 10 team instead of a top 4 team, according to many metrics and everything that I looked at. Now, on the flip side, they do have Juju Watkins, who is one of the best players in all of women's college basketball, averages 27 points and 7 rebounds. She's a problem. She's going to be very tough for Baylor to stop. They also have a really good big in Raya Marshall, who averages a double-double, which has been a problem for Baylor at times this year. Just rebounding and keeping people off the glass. Baylor also turns the ball over 16 times a game, which is really awful. USC does a good job of taking care of the ball. So I think, in general, this is a pretty tough matchup just from a star power standpoint. But if you look deeper, there's an opportunity here. If Baylor gets hot, if Jada Walker comes out, scores 28 points, if Sarah Andrews gets hot from three, I think this could actually be a game. But there's also an opportunity that a blowout happens as well. USC's done that to quite a few teams this year. So we'll see. I think that I would probably predict Baylor to lose this game. But I think there is some upset potential here.
I mean, they've got as good of a chance as anybody. You know, all you ask for is a chance, and they've got the opportunity. So certainly not favored going up against the number one seed, but they weren't favored necessarily against Virginia Tech, who is a higher seed. So it's part of the craziness. It's part of the madness of March, and certainly got to the end of that game, and there was plenty of madness. They were not necessarily great at the free throw line. And that was one of the things coming out of that game that we saw with the men, how that can come to bite you. Unfortunately, it came down to a much tighter game than you anticipated. And fortunately, on the flip side of the unfortunate part, is you were able to close it out and make big plays and make some free throws there at the end. Again, Jada Walker. And then play your foul smart and, take care of business and walk out of there with a W. So by the skin of their teeth, and certainly not without some drama, but 75-72 back in the Sweet 16, and now one-seeded USC on the horizon. And, you're walking in there as underdogs, but certainly feeling pretty good about the direction now. And I think this was needed for the program. I think this was needed for Nikki Collin. And I think that now you can not breathe a sigh of relief, but you can feel much better just in general about sort of the direction and stacking accomplishments on each other. So this was a big win in my mind, certainly not satisfactory to the point of you're full and you're like, all right, that's good enough, you want more, but man, this is I think a big step forward for the program.
Yeah, and I mean, they're only one of two Big 12 teams in the Sweet 16. That's a big deal. It's just them and Texas, I think, are the only ones left here. Kansas lost to USC by 20 or 18 this past weekend. Kansas State lost to Colorado. West Virginia lost to Iowa. So a lot of these Big 12 teams lost in this most recent round. Iowa State lost to Stanford in what was a really good game, actually. But, yeah, I mean, this is great for the program to be one of the two teams still standing. That's awesome. Now you got to go out and try to win these big games, these games that, you know, take you from having a really good season, because I do believe making the Sweet 16, you had a really good season. Now can you turn that into a great season, potentially cause some havoc here, maybe get an upset or two against USC and then probably against UConn, which, you know, both of those are very, very tough asks. But I think speaking of direction of the program, this is phenomenal. This is just absolutely great for Nikki Collin and company.
Yeah, so it was a very tight contest again, and a lot of fun to watch them be able to celebrate Virginia Tech with some opportunities. But, you know, to the Bears' credit, playing defense, being smart with their fouls, and then making it tough to get a shot there. So they advance, and it was a situation where you're hoping it was going to be a double dip of sweet, sweet celebrations this week, but that is not the case. So women advance, and on the bad news side of things, you've got the men who fall in the round of 32 for the third consecutive year, every year since they won their national championship in 2021, the third straight exit in the first weekend of the tournament, which is just not what you want to see, not what you we're hoping for, and not what you expected, but that is the case, and it's now leading to think pieces on the whole build of the team and the program and just everything else, of course. But 72-64, six-seeded Clemson beats the number three-seeded Bears to send them home from Memphis, and the ACC with a very strong outing so far with a quarter of the Sweet 16 field. May remember Jeff Capel, Pittsburgh head coach's comments. He was politicking because his team was on the outside looking in when it came to tournament seeds, but he made it a point along with Clemson's head coach to knock the Big 12 for their scheduling and kind of how they rigged up their scheduling, so to speak, to make their teams look better in the net rankings. I've seen a lot of conversation about the net rankings and whether those are going to be involved moving forward and whatnot, but I'm one of those, man. You can talk the talk, but I respect those who walk the walk. And the ACC, their coaches talked a little bit. Not that Jeff Capel went and did anything. They didn't make the tournament. But for the talk about the ACC, they've showed up. They've walked the walk. I mean, and they've beaten a couple Big 12 teams to send them home. So, are they the best basketball conference? I don't think we'll be saying that if Iowa State wins the national championship. That would be a feather in the Big 12's cap. But for right now, through two rounds, the ACC is standing the tallest amongst the conferences, with four teams still able to win a national championship, including the Clemson Tigers. So much like the ladies, but I think even worse, missed free throws. Except for with this team, it's kind of commonplace. Anytime we talk about a loss, I feel like we talk about missed free throws at some point or another usually. But defense, that's always a common theme, and shots not falling. You wondered in the first round, there's the whole, you know, the obvious joke of, did they use up all their shots? And maybe they did. Maybe they did in the first round because they weren't falling the way they were hoping for, at least in game number two. But all the things that I just laid out are the common complaints about when things aren't going the way that you want them to. Defense not where it should be, shots not falling, missing free throws, whatever else you want to point out, feel free to point out. But those are kind of the common things here, and those things all reared their ugly head, at least to some extent, in the loss to Clemson.
Right. I mean, this is a really tough one to explain in my eyes because, and you know, Garrett and I talked about this a little bit before, but, you know, the Baylor defense was not that bad in this game. I mean, they were able to stop Clemson multiple times, give them a shot to get close in the game as well. I know Clemson hit a, you know, miracle buzzer beater in the first half, or else they would have been held to 32 points in the first half, which, again, that's pretty good. So the tough part for me watching this game is just sitting there going, okay, so the thing that Baylor's done well all year, which is scoring the basketball, they just weren't able to do in this game. And I'm not even really going to credit Clemson that much because it felt like Baylor was getting open looks. I mean, wide open looks for large stretches in that game. Got to the free throw line a ton. Had chances for one and one, you know, going to the free throw line with a 1-1 chance and missing the front end of the 1-1. That's tough. I mean, just in general, when you have Jacoby Walter, who is an 83% free throw shooter, going to the free throw line, going 5 of 11 from the free throw line, including missing the front end of the 1-1, including missing two free throws with them being down by 2 points in the final minute of the game. It just is things that I know people are going to say, oh, at points this year they missed free throws. That's fine, but averages-wise and the way that they have shot the ball in stretches, it was kind of baffling to me to see them lose in this way, because it felt like to me if they're getting good looks in a basketball game, they were going to have a great opportunity to advance in the tournament. But they got those great looks, could not make them, and even with the defense playing pretty well and giving up 72 points with some of that coming in garbage time, they really did hold Clemson down for large stretches of this game, but ultimately it didn't matter, and Baylor loses again before the Sweet 16, which is 3 years in a row, and they've only advanced to the Sweet 16 twice in the last 9 NCAA tournaments.
Yeah, and I guess if you don't want to peg down on defense specifically in this game, I guess I'll rephrase it as it's an overarching theme with this basketball team. Their defense isn't good enough, the shots aren't falling, or they're missing free throws. It's a combination or all three of those things in every single loss that you look at, for the most part. I mean, there's some grouping of that, if not all three in some games, that inevitably costs them. And, you know, I guess put defense third and not bad enough to lose this game, but, you know, shots not falling when you're wide open looks. I mean, when you're given free shots at the free throw line with absolutely no pressure whatsoever and those aren't falling, I mean, that's just that's something that I think's become too commonplace, is the struggles at the free throw line at times. I don't know how to explain that. It's something we've been talking about for years, quite frankly. This is like the 100th time I brought it up, and I don't want to pretend to be like Mr. Basketball now, but it's just it gets brought up way too much to be an issue. Like, it just seems like the simplest thing and the most easily fixable thing, because some nights your shots just aren't going to fall, but you can make your free throws.
Yeah, and it's
some
crazy.
Nights you can't play defense, but you can make your free throws. And so that to me is just a frustration, but it happens. And again, it was a combination of things.
I mean, they're a 73% free throw shooting team on the year, which is a top 100 free throw shooting team. So not elite, but I mean, you're above average in that area. And then you show up in this game, you're 61.5%, and you miss multiple front end of the 1-1. So, I mean,
right, that's what kills you, is you miss those, and that's suddenly like another 6 points off the board that you potentially could have had in a game that you lost by less than double digits.
Yeah, so for me, we mentioned the defense. Yes, that has been a thing yearly. I didn't feel like it was the biggest thing in this game. The thing that definitely translated in this game, and we've seen it over and over and over from this team, slow start. They got down early. Clemson built a lead. Baylor couldn't quite come all the way back. That's something that we've seen all year long. Yes, they've been able to do it a couple times, but when you get down big, you run the risk of shots not falling and you not being able to get back in games. That was a problem. Secondly, the bigs. When the bigs haven't played well, Baylor has had major issues this year, and Yves Missi had 2 points, Josh Oh had 2 points, and Caleb Lohner had 0 points. Just not enough from the post, not enough scoring down low. And the crazy part is you're doing that with P.J. Hall, Clemson's probably best player, was on the bench for large stretches of this game in foul trouble, and Baylor's bigs couldn't take advantage of it. All of that really, really, in my eyes, led to this loss. And obviously, you know, when you look at Jaden Nunn going 1 of 8 from the floor, 3 points, that's not good enough either. And you really need to get more production from him. He felt very tentative in this game and felt like a guy who had great opportunities to score and just either didn't look for his shot or didn't have the confidence to take it. So really disappointed in that. Now on the flip side, Jacoby Walter, absolute warrior in this game. I know the free throws are a big bugaboo and something that was really, really tough to see from a 5-star freshman, but he laid it all out on the line. Rebounding, he had 6 rebounds, 20 points, felt like he was always around the basketball. Love to see that. And then Ray J. Dennis, who at times struggled in this game, but when it mattered most down the stretch, he gave Baylor a chance to win this game. I mean, he absolutely did. He willed them by scoring, getting in the lane, made a 3-pointer as well, 7 of 8 from the free throw line. Love to see that from him in his final game as a Baylor Bear.
Yeah, no, he was great in trying to will them to victory, but just Unfortunately, not enough. Ray J. Dennis, 27 points, played 39 minutes. Not the game that you wanted to see going out for Jalen Bridges with just 10 points.
Only shot the ball four times.
Yeah, four shots the entire night and four free throws. Hit a three, but just 10 points, five boards for him, one assist. Had a couple turnovers. Everybody seemingly had a couple turnovers, it felt like, at least at times. Not what you wanted to see from him necessarily in his final game. Missy, just a non-factor when you talk about like the impact on the game and what you would hope for, and especially in a situation like this, nowhere near being what you needed. Jaden Nunn, 3 points on the night. And then Jacoby Walter, you mentioned the 5-11 from free throws. That hurt big time. Did end up with 20 points. But, just not enough from the charity stripe. And again, it wasn't just missing a shot. It was missing the front end of one and ones. Yep. It's just a crush you. I mean, just leave so many points out there for the taking. Very little off the bench for the Bears, who didn't really go deep on the bench to begin with.
Been a story all year without Langston.
Langston Love, they missed him. And I know I saw, I guess, or maybe it was yesterday in a conversation, like, yeah, but with Langston Love, it was like, no, Langston Love would have mattered in this game. Yes. Like, he would have absolutely mattered in this game. And especially if you want to start talking about experience and how to rework the roster and all these things, well, then who better than a guy who's got plenty of experience in Langston Love? So, that hurt, but hey, everybody's dealing with injuries or has guys missing, and so that's just one of those, well, what if, that doesn't really matter in the long run. And so unfortunate that they didn't get to the second weekend, and then maybe he would have had a chance. I don't know.
Maybe.
I mean, it was so fuzzy around what was even what at
just
different
points. Just a
second
injury. It seemed like a re-injury. He just bad injury luck.
Yeah. And so, I mean, nothing you could really do about that. And so you rolled with who you got, and it wasn't enough against a very good Clemson team who now advances to the Sweet 16 and gives the ACC four of the 16 teams. But the Big 12 with two now, with a Houston and also Iowa State advancing. So we'll see if they can't try and win a third national title in the last 4 years and see somebody join Kansas and Baylor. ACC's got plenty to trash to talk after this week. NC State beat Texas Tech. I mean,
yeah, the tournament, I don't know. The tournament is sometimes very fluky, so no, I know
I don't
people want to draw
it.
Conclusions.
Yeah, I'm not Mr. Conference Pride by any means, but I'm saying for Jeff Capel to make the comments that he is and for everybody running around waving the Big 12 flag, like to have a quarter of the field is good bragging rights, but like I've said three times now, if Iowa State or Houston wins it at the end, then who cares? I mean, right. You're still going to be – the champ is what matters at the end, but it's been a good look for that conference through the first weekend.
Yeah, it has, and they've pulled off some huge upsets. NC State got hot at the right time, and then, of course, the Clemson win. Yeah. Two very surprising Sweet 16 teams, I would say. In general, though, I mean, for Baylor men's basketball, this was a very disappointing loss because I felt like this was a very winnable game. And there was nothing about Clemson watching them that said, wow, this is a really good Clemson team. Nothing that I saw from them really told me that. I think they're probably going to lose by double digits to Arizona, and maybe that would have happened to Baylor as well. But that's just kind of where I'm at, and that makes this loss particularly tough to see, especially as Baylor was trying to get over that second-round hump, which they haven't been able to get over in 3 years. It's just been kind of disappointing for stretches here, and that they're going to have to change the roster build and just kind of change the way I think they approach things going forward.
So Jalen Bridges will move on. Jacoby Walter will likely move on to the NBA. Unfortunate that the end of his career will be missing free throws that could have changed the outcome of this game. Eve's Missy, I guess we'll see. But he definitely can at least look into his options when it comes to the pros. Seems like a guy who would definitely benefit from coming back, but it's the NBA, and we don't know what's like in his mind or those around him. So that remains to be seen, and we can go up and down the roster. But Ray J. Dennis will be gone as well. But that's what I'm saying. You can go up and down the roster bit by bit. They're losing some guys. Some of them we don't know right now. But let me ask you, the knee-jerk reaction is, It's been great to have NBA draft picks, but we got to get back to having seventh-year seniors. And it's like, okay, well, you can do both. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can definitely have NBA draft picks and go deeper than the round of 32. I don't think getting blue-chip players is the reason why they're not making the round of 16 over the last 3 years. I understand the sentiment, but I don't think it's that black and white.
Look at UConn. They're old and they have pros.
Yeah, I don't think it's that simple of like you can't have one and dones and go deep in the tournament, right. Or you can't have a majority of young guys. And it's not the majority of one and dones. It's two guys. It's Eve Missy maybe, and it's Jacoby Walter.
Yeah.
That's it. Ray J. Dennis is senior old. Laden. Jalen Bridges is senior laden. So like I saw that from various corners of the internet, and that sentiment in the wake of this game of like, well, they got to completely redo how they do everything and no more NBA one and done guys and blah, blah, blah. Now, I will say this. Keontae George should be going to the Sweet 16.
Yep.
Jacoby Walter should be going to the Sweet 16. Jeremy Sohan should be going to the Sweet 16. Kendall Brown should be going to the Sweet 16. Kendall Brown probably should have stayed in school.
Yeah.
But my point is like they aren't doing what they should be doing. So the question becomes, I don't think it's as simple as let's get rid of one and dones because there's a bunch of old guys on this roster. I also don't think you can just magically recreate 2021 because guess what? Everybody's trying to do that, and that was a super unique situation.
Right.
So to me, I know it's boring, but it falls somewhere in the middle. So if you're Scott Drew this offseason, how do you look at your roster? How do you look at your program? And in your eyes, at least, where do you start when you think about potential of changes or direction? Are they on the right track still and it's just been bad luck? Do they need to retool the roster? What say you?
Yeah, I do want to mention the fact that, you know, when you look at kind of how they've built the rosters and how they've built recruiting classes, it's not just one and dones. They got really unlucky with Jeremy Sohan, and lucky and unlucky, right? Because he was so good in that 1 year that he ends up being a top 10 pick, but the expectation coming in was that he was going to be at Baylor for 2 years. That just didn't happen. So got really unlucky with that, and it really impacted their team the following year, the year they lost to Creighton. So last year, if he would have been on that team would have been far better. So it is somewhere in the middle, like you mentioned. I do think that you're going to see an emphasis on the transfer portal. And kind of what I mean by that is, I think this year they relied on, you know, Miro Little can maybe be in the lineup. You know, maybe Josh O's good enough to be your backup big this year. You know, Caleb Lohner can maybe give you some minutes here. I think they kind of are going to have to scrap that a little bit and find a way to just say, hey, you know what? If guys decide they want to transfer because they're not getting the minutes this year, well, then you know what? That's okay. Because they got to go out and add some talent to this roster, add veteran leadership, and really get back to the physicality that they used to have defensively as well, and that toughness on both ends of the floor. So, I mean, if you look at next year, you're going to get Jaden Nunn and you're going to get Langston Love back. That's great. I think that's a great starting point. I don't think that you should guarantee a starting role to maybe either of them. Love has dealt with a lot of injuries, so, you know, what are you going to expect from him there coming back? Is he going to be 100% for a full season? Hasn't really proven that. Jaden Nunn, is he really someone that you can absolutely pencil into your lineup for next year? Maybe. I think he's definitely good enough to start, and I think Langston is too, but if you can find a transfer portal guy that's an upgrade, I think they need to do that this year, and that's kind of where I'm at. If you have a chance to upgrade, do it. They're going to have to add a forward to replace Jalen Bridges. They're going to have to add a center if they lose Eves Misi. And they're probably going to look to add a point guard, which would allow either Jaden Nunn or Langston Love to come off the bench. And then you're only starting one freshman in BJ Edgecombe. And then you're bringing in Rob Wright and Jason Asamoah, who I think are both going to be at minimum two-year guys in the program. So once again, you're seeing they're going, okay, so we're going to have some veteran guys there. Miro Little will be in his second year. If you can keep him for another year, you'll have a third-year guy. And then I would honestly go out and add another transfer off the bench, a guy that can be a reliable defender who you can bring in case, you know, if VJ's having a freshman moment, you can bring him in to come in and guard and really provide some stability there. So in general, three transfers, roll with the guys that you brought back and then roll with the freshman that you're bringing in. And I think that's the best you can do from a mixture standpoint.
Yeah, and I don't think that, like to your point of when they put together these teams, they were thinking it was going to work out the exact way that it has with people's declarations. Yeah. Like they left when they left. It's like, no, you got a guy thinking he'd be here for 2 years and then he didn't. And then you're dealt a raw right. hand and then you got to react to that accordingly. I feel like sometimes with criticism, it's like, I just don't think people see it the way that it really is. They see it as like this perfect little thing mm-hmm. that's just so simple. And it's like, it's not that simple. It's like the roster construction is a lot more difficult than let's just have all 6 year seniors.
Right.
Like 2021 was unique, baby. Like that was not something that you're just going to duplicate all the time and have that. Like how old was Davion Mitchell and he went in the lottery? How many guys his age go in the lottery these days? Like none do practically. So, yeah, I mean, it's a nice idea, and you can definitely get older through the transfer portal, but at the same time with that, everybody's trying to get old through the mm-hmm. transfer portal. Everybody's watching the same games, and everybody's going, hey, man, did you notice the teams that are super old are going deep in the tournament? Yeah. Shh, don't tell anybody. We'll just keep that to ourselves and go grab all the old guys. It's like, no, everybody's realized that. And so it's just...
Except for Kentucky.
Baylor was the one that, like, set the example for that. And so, yeah, except for Kentucky. And they've got their own conversation about one and dones, but I guarantee you they're not trading any of that talent for just some fifth-year senior who's got, you know, some seasoning about him. I do think that what you run into, though, with some young guys is a pressure situation like Jacoby Walter at the free throw line, and that's where a guy who's like a fourth-year, fifth-year guy, maybe he is cool, calm, and collected enough to hit those free throws. Like, there is something to be said for experience, and you do need experience, but...
Or maybe Langston Love's healthy.
Or maybe Langston Love's
healthy. Which you can't prepare for, who would have been a third-year guy. Like,
right.
There are ways that you can look at this to kind of change the narrative on it and say, okay, well, could they have predicted Langston Love getting hurt? No. Like, and he was a huge part of what they were doing and a huge part of what they would bring in off the bench to kind of match anything that any other team could bring in off their bench. So not having him was huge. I do think there are some moments, like, if Baylor had a veteran center...
Yeah.
Would that have paid off big in this game? I think so. I think it would have won them this game if they had a veteran. So there are give and takes here, but you have to balance the roster. And that's why getting a guy like Jason Asamoah and Rob Wright as guys who you think will be at Baylor for more than 1 year, that's huge because now you get this star talent, but you get them for multiple years. That's a big deal. And then, of course, you know, just kind of amplifying everything with transfer. So you get older, stay talented, but also have the high ceiling of having NBA draft picks, which I do think you need to win a championship, which Baylor did with Davion Mitchell.
Yeah, it's like, well, they did win with NBA guys. Yeah. There were some NBA guys on that roster. Davion Mitchell was a lottery pick.
Jared Butler's playing in the
league
still.
Jared Butler was a second-round guy, but he was very much one of the best players in America, and he was not a young guy.
No.
And Davion Mitchell was not a young guy. So I understand the sentiment as far as all the one-and-dones here recently, but again, that wasn't the plan necessarily with some of those guys, and it's a combination. It's not as simple as like, well, let's just not have any NBA talent. Let's just stay old and grizzled, and that doesn't work either. There's a balance like anything in life, and that gets lost in conversation. So I think when everybody kind of settles down after they catch their breath, we'll realize like, it's not as bad as it appears. Now, you can't go much longer without getting to the Sweet 16. Like that, I mean, that's the thing that you know, rings true regardless of where you sit on the roster and the construction or the direction of the program or Scott Drew's plans or whatever. Something has to change to the point of where you're getting past the first weekend. I mean, mm-hmm. 3 years in a row, you really can't afford for that to be four or five because then you've basically done absolutely nothing with the momentum from a national championship. I mean, you did with NBA guys, and that's great. You did with recruiting, that's great. But in terms of adding and tacking onto that, little to nothing to show for it after the fact, really.
Right, and that's kind of why I do think they're going to be more aggressive in the portal, like taking four transfers instead of what this year they took two, right? The only two were Ray J and Jaden Nunn, I think, this year because they already had Bridges. I think they're going to double that next year. And that means taking a bench guy who you're just going to have on the bench, but he's a transfer. I think that's very important for what they're trying to do. And if they would have had a quality bench guy in this game, I know Langston was hurt, they'd probably win this game And so I do think that that will be very important. So you take four, three of them likely starters, and then one role guy, rotation guy, and then try to keep most of your other guys and add the recruiting class, I think is the way to go for this team going into next year. And I still trust that, I still have trust that they can turn things around, but there is just an edge, a physicality, and a grittiness that they absolutely need. And I know they lost in the second round of the tournament in 2022, but that team did have it with Sohan and Kendall Brown and Adam Flagler. Like, that team had the grittiness, but the last 2 years, I just haven't seen the same kind of physicality or defensive effort that we've, you know, come accustomed to.
So I would imagine all these conversations are ongoing in the basketball offices and, you know, the exit interviews and all those types of things that are now occurring as Baylor basketball on the men's side shuts it down after falling in the round of 32. So let everybody, you know, discuss however they will and come up with the best ideas and hopefully find a solution that's the perfect balance of star power, youth, and also veterans. But again, that's a combination everybody in America is trying to unlock. Baylor's been able to do it before. But these last 3 years ending far too early for people's expectations. So something does need to give there. And when you are bringing in star power, you definitely expect to get past the first weekend with the likes of the Keontae Georges and the Jacoby Walters and the Jeremy Sohans and et cetera. So I don't know. I don't think getting rid of those guys means you advance. But something's just – they just got to get over that hump, man. And this one bugs you because you know that they – they could have won this game, and we could be talking about them in the Sweet 16, but instead it's just another disappointment. So back to the drawing board and a long off season ahead. No one disappointed, more disappointed, I'm sure, than Scott Drew, but there will be plenty of basketball conversation over on the premium section and the free boards as well of Sikkim365.com. If you want to give your two cents on the roster or the NBA guys or Drew's approach or whatever, everybody's entitled to their opinion, and it's good to hear others' opinions, and so you can go air out those grievances or air out those opinions over on the boards, and there's plenty of combo happening there since the game ended the other night, so there is that for you. But meanwhile, the women, we don't have to, you know, wrap up anything with them. As we talked about at the very beginning, they're in the Sweet 16 and still alive, so we'll see what happens in their next round. But moving on to football, we had more spring practices this past week and more talks from assistant coaches. We've heard from Dave Aranda. We've heard from Jake Spavital, new OC. We've heard from Anoki Brechterfield as well. I think that was yesterday, right? I didn't get to go to that one. I had a piece on the quarterback situation, being that it's an open competition. I think we all feel like Daquan Finn's the guy ultimately there, but it's spring ball, so they're having a competition. We got to hear from Sawyer Robertson, got to hear from RJ Martinez and Daquan Finn as well. What I guess in particular stands out to you, or what would you like to discuss from spring football? Anything, stand out to you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things. You mentioned the quarterback competition. If it's not Daquan Finn, then they made a huge error in judgment as far as the transfer portal goes.
Be a really highly paid backup quarterback.
Yes, he cannot, you can't bring in a guy of that caliber and that talent and what they thought of him coming in and then not start him. That would be just absolutely shocking. And you know, I know Sawyer Robertson is a good player, and I expect Sawyer to be the guy next year. But for this year, this needs to be Daquan Finn's team if, you know, the NIL effort is going to pay off. I mean, so hopefully that gets figured out during the spring. Outside that, you know, I do want to talk about the offensive line a little bit. And it was something that I noticed early on and I was very curious about, because last year, I had a lot of questions about strength and conditioning, specifically the weight of the offensive line, the strength, you know, what were they going to look like? And they just got bullied last year. And it caused me to have some concerns about what that was going to look like going into this offseason and maybe how they changed their approach. And with the new scheme coming in, I think you're seeing that they really want their guys to be bigger and stronger and heavier up front. And for that reason, I dug a little bit deeper and tried to figure out, you know, how bad was it last year? You know, how much did these guys weigh? Well, they had zero guys last year who weighed over 320 pounds, and they had just two guys who weighed over 310 pounds going into last year. That is a shocking number, especially when you look at their roster this year, where they have four guys over 320 pounds and five more who are over 310 pounds. That is a massive shift brought in by Chris Kapilovic for a little bit, and now Mason Miller and Jake Spavital, just this new scheme in general, they're getting a lot bigger up front, and I'm really, really intrigued by that. The starting unit that I saw so far that seems to be the guys right now, the weights are 315 pounds, 337 pounds, 321 pounds, 311 pounds, and 300 pounds up front. That group is Alvin Ebbasele, Kurt Daneker, Colton Price, Omar Egbedian, and then Campbell Barrington. That's the starting lineup that I've seen so far. Things can obviously change. Caden Soraki, Gavin Byers are two guys to definitely keep an eye on in battles right now. But I was very intrigued by that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a group that has a lot to prove and a lot of unknowns surrounding it right now. I mean, last year it was expected to be such a, or was it 2 years ago, it was expected to be such a surefire thing with everybody returning, and it was not at all. And then last year was not good whatsoever. So it's been a couple years since this O-line's really been able to establish itself. And obviously, a couple changes. Kapilovic in and out the door, like the, is that Grandpa Simpson meme, I think? the Grandpa Simpson meme. And then, having to make another change, it's got everybody, I think, really just in a daze as far as the busyness of just the staff turnover and the timing of it all and all of that. But that is a particular group that is having to get to know two new coaches, basically. I mean, you just started to get to know a guy, and then he's like, all right, see you later, guys. It's like, wait a second, I just learned like your kids' names, and you're out the door already. And now having to restart that process. So is the D-line. You know, there's a lot of newness around, but with the offensive line, hopefully they can find some consistency and find their groove. And, yeah, I do think they need to find some more size. They didn't look the part here recently. And, I haven't paid much attention to them in practice, but I will start to maybe take a bit more of a glance over there, because that is going to be where it all starts and stops. You know, is Daquan Finn running for his life, or is he running because he chose to run because he's got that option in front of him? Here lately, it's been a lot of quarterbacks running for their lives,
right?
The last couple of years. I mean, to the point of kind of absurdity that it is so regular that that's been the case. And that's hence why there's a change.
Yeah, this
hopefully helps out.
Yeah, this offensive line looks more like the Art Briles offensive lines, where some of them weren't the most athletic guys.
You don't have to be the total package either. You don't have to be an NFL draft pick.
But they need you to move people.
Right.
And that's a big thing that I think you're seeing with this unit. And you're seeing it, and I mean, they need to do it because they got a very athletic quarterback, a game changer running the football. Really, both of them. Sore Robertson's a very good runner as well. But then you also have this stable of really good running backs that you'd really like to feature. I mean, when you look at Richard Reese and Dominic Richardson and Dawson Pendergrass and Bryson Washington, it's a good group. And I mean, you want to be able to showcase them and actually create some holes for them. So very intrigued by the offensive line. A few other just notes on the offensive line. Isaiah Robinson up to 6'6", 330 pounds. The former four-star prospect is currently the backup for Alvin Ebbasele at left tackle. I found that to be very interesting. The two freshmen, Colton Soraki and Tristan Santoro, are both over 310 pounds already, arriving as early enrollees. So some really, really positive momentum there, and something that I definitely kept an eye on. Where do you want to go to next? Do you want to go to the defensive line?
I mean, we can. I just wanted to say that I enjoyed hearing from the quarterbacks. Sawyer Robertson does look like he's put on some weight, which, man, I'm not jaded, but I've seen enough of these now at this point that's not like I don't fall for like he's gained 15 pounds this offseason nearly as much as like I used to, because that's just what guys do. They get into the program and they add on weight, and some of it is notable, don't get me wrong, but like I don't think it's a surprise that Sawyer Robertson added weight. Like I just think that's obvious that
he
would do
5 pounds here and there,
right? Yeah. And so like, I mean, he mentioned that, which is reason I bring it up, because I'm like, okay, that's cool, whatever. But, you know, outside of that, nothing that, like, stands out really, but he feels comfortable. He seems to feel a lot more confident based on the experiences that he got last year. So I think that is something that plays well, as RJ Martinez played slightly last year, but he played a lot before he got to Waco. Sawyer Robertson's now played more than he had previously. And then, obviously, Daquan Finn has a lot of experience. Finn, a more seasoned guy at this point. Martinez, pretty seasoned. And now Robertson getting there as far as his body goes and being a veteran and just getting bigger. So I think all that to say that I think this room's about as stout as you could possibly hope for. And it's just refreshing to This is nothing anti-Blake Shapen, but it's just refreshing to kind of turn the page and have a new room, even if there's a couple of returning faces. And just it feels fresher and it feels new, and I think it needed to feel that way after kind of getting used to the same thing these last few years. But they don't really suffer, I don't think, this time around, knock on wood, barring injuries, from the total lack of experience that they suffered from last year at quarterback, across the team, just in general. I think the quarterback room's very sturdy now, and that's kind of what I walked away with, was like, yeah, they've got a couple veterans, and now Sawyer's got some time, and he's clearly growing up, so I feel good about that room. If they can get the blocking, I like the weapons around them. I think the quarterback room's something you can feel good about.
Yeah, and I would say that last year there was a lot of hot takes about Sawyer early on without kind of realizing the fact that he was moving to a completely new offense last year. That wide zone scheme was not what he was used to running at Mississippi State, and now he's actually getting back to more what he did at Mississippi State, which I think is going to benefit him really well. I think he's going to be very calm and poised. And I think if he does come into games, I mean, if he does start games, I think he's going to be pretty successful. So, yeah, pretty intrigued by that group as well. I feel really good about it. They're going to get Adam Schobel next year, maybe, if they're able to hold on to him. And yeah, he's another really, really good prospect.
And I didn't mention Nate Bennett, but I'm just – he's not in the mix right now. I mean, as far as, like, starting quarterback roles, but he's a good – fourth quarterback to have behind three guys who are older, wiser, more experienced. So I think Nate is in the perfect spot of being a true freshman who can just sit back, learn, go put on some weight. He definitely needs to do that. But there's no pressure for him to, like, be ready to start anytime soon.
Excellent team and role guy right now.
Right.
And he'll do that. And that's a huge reason why he was brought in, because he just will fit in really well with that group.
And I had to, like, preface the article the other day and say, like, hey, he didn't get brought up by Spavital, but when the question was asked, it was like, hey, how do you feel about the three starting quarter or the three quarterbacks competing? And so he wasn't an afterthought, but he kind of was, you know, and that's just only because he's the fourth quarterback and he's the young guy who just got here. So there's not major expectations or pressure on him. So just to clarify, like, why didn't we hear about Nate Bennett very much? Well, you shouldn't be hearing about him a whole lot right now, unless he is just like the second coming of Tim Tebow or Vince Younger. Well, not good timing with Vince Young today, huh? No. The second coming of any great quarterback, Joe Burrow. He's not supposed to be that right now, and he's not probably ever going to be Joe Burrow. Nobody really is, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. So I do want to kind of shift the conversation a little bit on the offensive side even more. I mean, it is so much fun to watch this group practice with Jake Spavital out there, and I mentioned this when we talked on Friday, but just how they're just lined up running these four wide receiver sets, and these quarterbacks are just getting a ton of reps in with these receivers. I think it's going to be extremely important. It's very, very fun to watch in practice. It seems like the guys are having a lot more fun at the receiver position and the quarterback position as well. Just tons of reps. And that was something I really noticed. When you see a sudden shift from what one staff was doing to a new staff, you can really see the differences. And I remember, that when the old staff was here, it was a lot of, throw to the tight end for a little bit, make some throws to the receivers. But it felt like those guys were with their position coach a ton. Whereas with Jake Spavital and these guys, it seems like they're going to be getting reps in with the quarterbacks, with the receivers, with the running backs, with the tight ends far more. I mean, I think that's going to be really important. I think we need to see a big jump from the wide receiver group. And in order for that to happen, they got to get comfortable with these quarterbacks and get more reps in my eyes.
Yeah, one of the things that Jake Spavital said, and some of these conversations, I can't get into every detail because it would be 4,000 words, right?
Yeah.
So I kind of picked my spots on what the theme is, and so with him, I decided to focus in on just his thoughts on the quarterbacks individually. But he did bring up that they challenged the receivers, and this is stuff that I'll probably trickle out through, like, the summer months and stuff. Mm-hmm. But one of the comments he did made was about them, like, talking to the receivers and getting them on, like, hey, who's your guy at quarterback? Like, finding your guy and, establishing those relationships. And there's going to be some pressure on the receivers. This isn't like, hey, you guys are young, don't, just come along. They know that, like, that was not good enough last year, and you could at least pull the youth card. You can't pull that again this year. And you brought in some veteran wide receivers, like Jaheim Bell and Ashton Hawkins.
Yeah.
And now even the young guys are like juniors. You're like in your third and fourth years. It's time to perform, man. So there's definitely an expectation for the wide receiver group to perform at a very high level this year, and they need that. And that was part of what was missing last year, is you just didn't have that that game-breaking ability to help you out at times when you really needed it. A lot of games last year, there was afterthoughts.
And you couldn't run the ball. And so you couldn't for run your the receivers ball. So, to be an afterthought is...
Yeah, and couldn't get separation was always the line that you'd always hear, right? After every game, it felt like, when talking about the wide receivers. But just in general, they look the part. They've got some veterans now. They've got an offense that's wide receiver friendly. They've got a multitude of quarterbacks to go and develop relationships with. I mean, there's really nothing that should be holding them back at this point from taking the big step forward.
No, and I mean, Ashton Hawkins looks the part. That guy is going to be a go-to guy in this offense from the slot. He looks phenomenal. He's going to be utilized on many routes, whether it's wheel routes, go routes, the deep crossers especially, screens. I mean, everything. He's going to be utilized. Jamal Bell as well, like you mentioned, the Nevada transfer.
Yeah, say Jaheim.
Yeah, Jamal Bell. I mean, he's a 4.43 laser 40 guy. This guy's a burner. He's also going to be a huge impact guy in special teams. I love to see the weight gains from Ketron Jackson. He looks much bigger, stronger, more physical. Hopefully that'll allow him to win contested balls.
Jaheim Bell was a tight end for FSU. That's where that came in my head. But
they just look a lot better. And
they do.
Monterey, he wasn't even out there the first day that I was out there, but he's a guy who's going to be important. Jordan Neighbors made the move back to receiver. He's going to be playing
good.
The slot.
He looks good. Yeah, you know, he looks the part. Who was the other person you said? Ketron looks bigger.
Yeah.
He definitely looks bigger. I mean, the wide receivers look the part.
They do. Kyle Presley.
Compared to last year, for certain, where they did still kind of look young in some ways. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, Ketron looks impressive. To be sure. So, yeah, I mean, I think we agree that it's time for them to take a step, and they have all the ingredients in place to be able to do that.
Yeah, and when I was out there, Michael Trigg wasn't out there for the day. I don't know if he was when you saw, and neither was Steve Linton. So I'm curious if they're out there today. That's going to be something definitely to keep an eye on. I do want to mention, we need to talk a little bit about the defensive line, because Jarrell Boykins and Trey Emery both medically retired. That was huge news last week. I kind of had a feeling it was coming. I've hinted it a few times on the Bearcast and obviously on the website as well. So they're both gone. So you lose two nose tackles, not ideal. And now they're trying to work this group together. And I kind of mentioned in my insider notes on the premium side of things, you know, guys like Kyan Roberts-Day, Trey Wilson, DK Kalu, Brendan Bett, that group of four are going to be really, really important to this team's success, because I think we kind of know what Baylor's going to get from Cooper Lands and Jackie Marshall if Marshall stays healthy. But that group of four, and then also Trevin Maya, but that group of four right there, just complete unknowns in my eyes. Like, you've seen flashes at times, you like their athletic profile, is it going to be a every single game type of thing? That's going to be a huge question mark. There's plenty of upside in that group, but we just kind of, you need to see it.
Yeah, and that's a concern now. And much like with trying to go and get more seasoned in the basketball portal, which is doable if you're not looking for a superstar veteran. Mm-hmm. It's you can go and find guys who have some age and some wisdom and all that, but. Man, going and trying to find quality defensive linemen in the portal at this point is just it's going to be tough, man. Everybody wants them. Everybody's looking for them. Everybody has a need for them, even when you have a bunch of them. You still want more. It's one of those premium position groups. And I know there's differences, nose tackles and D tackles. And nose tackle in particular is what Baylor's dealing with is an issue right now. But, it's going to be – I'm very curious to see their – potential targets in the transfer portal about what they could possibly do, because they're going to have to add some bodies, just bodies. I mean, much less talent, but they're going to have to add some bodies for depth.
And that leads me into an offer they sent out this past week to Philip Blitty, the defensive line prospect out of Indiana. He moved from Texas Tech last spring to Indiana, played the season there, had 30 tackles, 4 for loss, 11 QB hurries, 11 stops, according to PFF. He actually graded, according to PFF, his grade was better than any defensive lineman for Baylor last year. That's not saying a ton, but it would be a huge improvement. He's 6'3", 300 pounds. I know we've talked a lot about the nose tackle position. I don't think it's necessarily that they have to address nose tackle specifically. They just have to address the interior of the defensive line. They need good players, and they need veteran talent there. not necessarily finding an Apu-Ika, even though that would be ideal, obviously, that's just not necessarily realistic to find a guy like that so easily. So Bleedy gets offered, and you just mentioned the fact that, oh, you know, what's it going to be like for Baylor competition-wise to land a defense lineman out of the transfer portal? Well, he's visiting Washington, Arizona, probably Baylor and LSU, Texas, Texas A&M, TCU, Oklahoma, and West Virginia are all recruiting him. So it's really going to come down to, you know, what's he looking for? Because if you go to some of those schools, you're going to be like the seventh defensive lineman. You go to Baylor, you're probably going to be starting. And so there's kind of the difference there. And
like, does Texas really need more D-linemen?
I know, yeah.
That's what I mean, though, about everybody wants them, and even if you have them, you want more of them. And that's why it's just it's such a tough spot to be in, losing two guys just right at the start of spring ball, even if you had a heads up on it.
Not much.
You didn't have much of one. Yeah. And not enough to make up for it by spring ball. So, yeah, that's just...
They didn't have a heads up.
You can't crater next season based on that, but, man, it sucks. Like, it's a bad dose of bad news.
They didn't have the heads up to where they could have addressed it during the first portal part.
Right.
And so that makes it tough because you can't really do anything about it right at this very moment. So now you got to go out and recruit guys. And so Philip Bleedy gets an offer. He's only got 1 year of eligibility. So he would literally come in, try to make an impact this year. His sights are set on the NFL. And so, you know, maybe Baylor's the place that could get him there. I know he's got interest. I do think he'll take an official visit at this moment. But a lot can change as these offers keep rolling in. A&M literally offered yesterday. So a lot to sort out there. But that just takes something to keep in mind as Baylor's going to be aggressive, specifically attacking the front seven in general and the defensive line in the transfer portal.
All right. So there is football, and we've got plenty more to go. Still several practices remaining. Green and gold game, obviously, coming up in about 3 weeks or so, I guess. And we'll have a media session today, as a matter of fact, that I'll head to watch practice.
Same.
Noki Brechterfield spoke yesterday. I don't know who's in line to speak today, but we'll have more stories and articles and just general gossip and talk all throughout the website, sikkim365.com, and each week on this podcast as well. But we're actually out there at practice and taking it all in and passing along what we can to you, so long as... as there's news to pass along. All right, so that about it, I think. Again, women in the Sweet 16, basketball season for the men is over. I have a feeling, without even looking at the mailbag, that'll probably be a hot topic, and football in full swing and looking pretty good. I guess baseball lost their series to Texas. Got one.
Yeah.
Got one, which was great to see, but dropped the next two to lose the series to UT. But we've got a ways to go with baseball, and that's that's been an up-and-down affair so far, so we'll keep tabs on that. But for this episode, at least, that's about it in terms of the diamond. All right, to the mailbag we go. GMAC, with the Baylor men's basketball exit from the tournament, is this Scott Drew's most painful loss?
No. No, losing to Duke in 2010, where you're in the Elite Eight and you have a great chance to make the Final Four, and maybe even more than that, because that team was really rolling at that point in the season. That's, I think, probably number one. Number two, I actually think, is North Carolina in 2022, because North Carolina ends up making a run to the national championship. They play Kansas. They're up big in that game. They end up giving up a lead, and Kansas wins it. But just that path to the Final Four, I think there's a legit case that Baylor could have made that run to the Final Four, maybe even the national championship with the team that they had. They just ran into Brady Manick's 28 points and a half, and it cost them.
Yeah, definitely not the most painful loss, but it hurts. I think they all hurt to some extent. Scott Drew's going to put a brave face on, and, you know, I'm sure behind the scenes curse under his breath a little bit, but yeah, I don't think it's anywhere close to the most painful loss.
Because this team wasn't going to win the national championship.
No.
We all know that, so I think that's the difference.
Yeah, yeah. You had an opportunity that in the Duke game in particular. You were knocking on the door, so to speak, and that was one that, if you hadn't won that 2021 national championship, that would still be hanging over your head just the worst memory ever, but it's lightened by the fact that they were able to eventually win a title. But yeah, that one definitely worse. What can he and the rest of the coaching staff do to move on past the round of 32 next year?
Yeah, I mean, reset the roster, tons of transfers, get back to physicality, energy, defense, like we mentioned earlier. We kind of deep dive into to this specific question. But, yeah, I think that's all you can really do because I still like the strategy that they've gone with. I know Ashley has mentioned it on the board as well. The strategy is not to completely go away from one-and-done type athletes and prospects. But what it is to bring in transfers who fit and fill in the roster and maybe don't take as many high school recruits. That's a possibility.
Yeah. I think the whole let's get away from blue chips is not the answer. I think the let's just get three blue chips a year is not the answer either. It's like everything else, somewhere in the middle. You can have a great blue chip future lottery pick, but yeah, you need to have veterans around him. It's a recipe. You got to find the right ingredients, and I think that maybe they've had a little bit too much salt, you know, lately, or a little bit too many tomatoes, or, you know, however you want to phrase it. The ingredients have been out of balance, out of whack a little bit, yep. And they need to find what that perfect recipe is, and they had it in 2021, but that's just really hard to duplicate. So, the portal additions, what should we be looking out for? There's a thread over on the boards right now. Ashley's chimed in on it and said some of what Grayson just repeated about sort of the strategy moving forward. There's a lot of posts to check out to go really in-depth, GMAC, which I'm sure you probably already noticed on the website. But for anybody else, if you want to get into the weeds on plans moving forward for Baylor basketball and takeaways from the loss to Clemson and how do they reinvigorate the program and get back to – you know, the second weekend, a lot of that conversation happening now over on the boards.
Yeah, and I have three names that Baylor's already reached out to in the transfer portal, specifically for basketball. Rutgers center Clifford Amorui, two-time All-Big Ten selection, averaged 10.5 points, 8.3 rebounds, and 2.9 blocks. He's about to enter his fifth season of college basketball. He's been very productive the last 3 years. And as I mentioned earlier, if this guy was on their team this year, they probably are a one seed and they're probably advancing in the tournament. So he's a big name to keep an eye on. Stanford guard Cannon Carlisle. He was a five-star freshman. He's about 6'3", averaged 11.5 points, 2.7 rebounds, 2.7 assists. Really good athlete, really good length, good feet, can guard, an explosive athlete. He missed the first month of the year there at Stanford, but I do think he's a really good prospect. His comp on 247 I found really interesting is actually Davion Mitchell. So I don't know, something to keep an eye on there. And then all West Coast Conference first teamer and Pepperdine wing, Michael Ajayi. He's 6'7", 220, would kind of fill in that Jalen Bridges role. He averaged 17 points, 9.9 rebounds, shot 47% from three. He was at community college for his first 2 years, played at Pepperdine this year, so he's technically a senior age-wise, but has only played 1 year of D1 basketball. He's got visits set up to Gonzaga and Ole Miss, but those three guys are the three that I know Baylor's been in contact with up to this point.
And again, if you want constant news coming out of the program and conversations like the targets in the portal and all that, as that starts to really ramp up and will be as chaotic as you can imagine, I would think, then definitely head on over to the premium section, sikkim365.com, here over the coming weeks and months. And Ashley, for starters, and Kendall and everybody else on staff will have a lot of hoops news coming your way, even though the season's over with. BU Grad 21, is there a thank you, GMAC? Is there any case to be made for, and he said too, thank you guys for keeping us updated with all things Baylor sports, Sikkim Bears. Thank you, GMAC, for that. BU Grad 21, is there any case to be made for Missy to stay one more year at Baylor?
Yeah, I mean, the case is he had a really bad NCAA tournament. Maybe it pushes him just slightly out of the lottery. Maybe if he's not a lottery pick, does that maybe influence him a little bit? I'll also mention, I think the biggest thing for him is he reclassified. So he was supposed to be a senior in high school this year. He reclassified to get to Baylor a year early. So I just kind of wonder if his overall plan was to be at Baylor for 2 years. And that could dictate some things. And obviously, if they bring him back, then you're not going to need to add another starting center because Eves will obviously be the starting center. But that's kind of the thing that I look towards, that reclassification. Does that make him change his mind because he's so young at this moment?
Scotty B, the Baylor King, or Virginia Tech fans saltier than McDonald's French fries? It's pretty darn close, in my opinion, based on reactions on social media, especially towards Nikki Collin talking to refs. All I can say to those folks are in my best impression of Jack Nicholson in the movie A Few Good Men, You Can't Handle the Truth. This is in terms of Baylor making more plays to win the game.
Yeah, I mean, Baylor won that game. I mean, they absolutely did. They won it on the road as well. I don't know how you can complain that much in my eyes.
Well, people are sore losers. That's one thing that you can bank on is some people especially feel like anytime their team loses, it's because of something, you know, it was the officiating or it was, I mean, point to something. People will come up with any reason to excuse why their team lost, and Virginia Tech fans are awfully salty, but Baylor was on the road. They came in and beat you and made the plays at the end to win the game. So that's just part of the deal, Scotty, is people don't like losing. I mean, this culture does not like losing in any way, in anything, and so it's not a surprise that Virginia Tech fans are salty. I think if Baylor fans had lost the same way, it would probably be much the same, but enjoy that and enjoy Nikki Collin and company getting a big win. Doc Crowell, portal heavy questions this week, guys. Apologies in advance. The spring portal window expected to be crazy. What are the chances we find a star true nose in the mold of Apu?
Yeah, very low. I mean, it's very hard to find a guy like that. Baylor was able to get him because of Dave Aranda's connections as well. And so that was also kind of right before NIL really took off, and so I think that matters as well. So again, very low, but I also don't think Baylor is specifically just looking for a true nose tackle. I think they're looking for just really good players on the interior of the defense line, even if that means just a defensive tackle who's right at 300 pounds. Would it be ideal to find a 340-pound hyper-athletic guy like Apu? Obviously, that would be what you would want, but it's hard to find guys like that. So really, it's just about increasing the depth and increasing the talent, honestly.
And there are rumblings about Apu and just his stature and the NFL and how that would translate. And obviously, he was picked relatively high. Third round guy. It's relatively high.
Or fourth, something like that.
Yeah, now you're going to have me doubt myself. Whenever it was, before round five, he got drafted and has not made much of a dent in the NFL whatsoever. And I just think back to the conversations that were being had about him and, you know, just the work ethic and translating and maturing and those types of things. And it was always alluded to or kind of talked around or whatever, but it was, you know, so long as he showed up and ate up tackles on Saturdays, it didn't matter much. But I think you're seeing that now as lack of NFL career. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, lack of playing time and all that's just kind of made it more obvious that he's got more that he's leaving out on the table for whatever reasons.
And we definitely saw that in 2022.
And we definitely saw that.
Because it regressed.
Yeah.
2021, he was unblockable.
Right. Yeah. He was not as good in 2022, and so I think I said all that not to knock Apu, but to say, like, he was not just available and a great player. Like, there was reasons why he was available. You know what I mean? Yeah. And the Dave Aranda part, that connection is what brought him to Baylor, because otherwise he's probably a guy who's going and looking at the highest bidder and just saying, all right, I'm going to Ohio State. I don't care if I play. I'm just going to go for the money or whatever and see how it all plays out. He's a great player, but I think that was a really unique situation where – it just was very fortunate for Baylor and not something you can bank on happening on a like, oh, we need a nose tackle. Let's go get an Apu guy, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So I wish it was that easy, though. Have you heard any general rumblings of Baylor players wanting to enter the portal when it opens again without revealing who?
I mean, I there are going to be guys who leave. So let me just put it that way. Baylor actually needs guys to leave because they currently don't have roster spots for it, which you're going to ask about. They don't have roster spots right now to add more guys because once they bring in the rest of the freshman class, it's going to take up all their scholarships. They're going to have to lose guys. They will lose guys. And, you know, you just hope that the damage isn't significant, which I don't think it will be compared to what they would be able to bring in to replace those guys. Because you're going to lose depth guys, and they really need high-end starters, not just guys who have just sat on the bench for a long time.
How many scholarships are we working with when the portal opens?
So currently they don't necessarily have any, but obviously if they're offering guys, it alludes to the fact that they're going to have scholarships to work with. I think they'll probably take, you know, my guess would be like 3 to 5 transfers after the spring. I think there is going to be some craziness there. You're going to lose some guys who are depth pieces. Hopefully you're not losing any highly, you know, guys who are going to contribute. And then from there, you know, hopefully you go out and add some guys who can backfill them who are better, you know, higher quality guys. So again, right now, none, but I would just say if you're going to just kind of read the tea leaves, they're sending out offers. It means that there are going to be scholarships available.
Useless Kim DeGree, are there any shockers or surprises you can see coming when it comes to position battles this spring? I'm curious if the staff changes give anyone we aren't expecting a bump or a surprise role in the two deep.
I mean, I
tell you what, Spavitzal's, this is not, he's not going to beat out Daquan Finn, but Spavitzal's comments on RJ Martinez I thought were very interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, he kind of lit up when he talked about RJ Martinez, which I just thought was a cool thing, but that's not going to change. Like, he's not going to beat out Daquan Finn, like I said. But,
yeah. No, I don't see that either. I don't think he'll beat out Sora Robertson either. No, but, probably not. You know, who knows? You know, this is such a tough question because you're just asking too deep. I think you see surprises in the too deep all the time. So, yeah, of course there can be. I guess if you're looking for some specific ones, you know, maybe Isaiah Robinson really takes over that left tackle role as a second string guy, which I'm not sure many people expected coming into the season. He's put on 31 pounds this offseason, so he looks like a completely different player and definitely one that is rising. He was a raw prospect coming in, but it seems like he's really, you know, figuring it out from his body standpoint and trying to make sure that he stays healthy. So, you know, maybe he's one. I'm trying to think of, like, who would be a surprise after how bad they were last year to make the two deep. You know, like, I feel like you want guys who didn't play a lot last year to take that jump. So, young guys, Trey Wilson, you know, maybe he's the starter at field end. Kyne Roberts-Day, maybe he gets into the two deep this year and really provides an impact. I think those are a couple guys. You know, maybe Kylan Reed, the freshman, maybe he gets in the two deep at linebacker. I could see that as well. Another very productive player there. I think those are kind of the main ones. I think receiver, we pretty much know the guys that are going to be in the fold there. Defensive back as well. I think we pretty much know.
Yeah, I mean, they're a team with a lot of returning experience, and I think that we kind of know what's what. I don't really think there's, like, a lot of shockers or surprises in store. Like, oh, my God, didn't see that guy coming. Because I think not only are they coming off of a year of inexperience where they're more experienced, but I just think that while there's nobody just domineering at the top of, like, having a stranglehold on the positions, I mean, it is kind of clear-cut of, like, who's who in the pecking order. And I don't think there's anything that's, like, super notable as far as the battle for this position.
No,
so
like
to speak.
Caden Jenkins, Carl Williams, Matt Jones, they're all starting. Like, right. They're going to start in some way. You know, maybe a guy like DJ Coleman, who played some last year, maybe he can jump into the safety position and you know, shock some people, maybe as a starter. He's an interesting one. It's just hard at this very moment since we've only seen spring. And I think the two deep is pretty clear cut. The better question is who's going to start in my eyes. That's where you have more of a decision-making process.
Yeah. So Kim Degree, or useless Kim Degree, I should say, stay tuned on that as we get more practices and more storylines develop. And I mean, look, we're going to have to basically reset post spring anyways, mm-hmm. With everything, which is just another kind of new part of the new age of college football. Is what you leave with spring doesn't necessarily mean what you're going to show up with in the fall. So there's a lot of unforeseen stuff potentially down the line, and maybe not. Maybe it's a real quiet spring and off season for them. Hopefully it will be, but nothing in the works right now, but that could always change, I guess, is the point that I'm trying to make.
Yeah, and I did get one question in just our chat. Nose tackle down to one. It's not down to one. Brendan Bett, Cooper Lands, and then Tonga Lolohia is currently who would be filling in at nose tackle if you were specifically looking at that position. Just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, and Tonga is a guy that they mentioned, I don't know if, I guess it was random maybe, that they have now said, like, yeah, we got to really maximize him while he's here, mm-hmm. And take advantage of, what does he have, a couple years?
Yeah, he's got
coming
two.
From TJC, so he's got 2 years to play, and they got to really maximize those 2 years at that position, because as we've documented, it's really hard to find guys at that position, especially good players. So they're on the hunt, but so is everybody else, but you have what you have, and so you got to get the absolute best out of that you can. So that's the focus right now. But, they definitely have their eyes out on the warpath looking for more. Bears 224, after seeing some practice, what's your confidence level that Dave Aranda's team will do what it takes to keep Dave's job? Scale of 1 to 10, maybe.
I think it's so early to predict that. I do think they're going to be better than last year, but does that mean that they're going to be able to save Dave Aranda's job? I don't know the answer to that. So I think right now it's probably at a 5 because I don't think we have a clear answer. I mean, it's only spring football and it's been a week.
Yeah, I'd say 6. It's exactly what Grace says. Too early to really have a great feel for everything. We need to get into, like, August and know who's on the team still to really feel good about predicting in August what this team could look like and what they could do during the season. So, yeah, it's a little bit early to feel confident in a Dave Aranda's job safety rating. But I'll go six because I think I like a lot of the moves they've made. I think Gary Patterson was a valuable addition to take some of the workload off of Dave Aranda's plate and help out with the defense. I think the assistant hires, given the kind of craziness that was, the hiring cycle, hiring guys and them leaving abruptly, you made out well in the long run. I think the talents obviously stuck around for the most part, and they've gotten older and wiser and more experienced, but yeah, still too early to kind of know what all that adds up to just yet, but I'll lean they're heading in the direction of saving his job, so a six for me. USC women appear to be beatable, as from Master Pierce, MPH. Kansas largely beat themselves last night with 20-plus turnovers, and a lot of them were unforced. What does Baylor need to do defensively to really stifle Juju? Offensively, how do we attack them? Second-chance points are going to be crucial in this game. Talking about the Sweet 16 matchup with the Bears and the Trojans.
I mean, Baylor needs to take care of the basketball, but they haven't taken care of the basketball a year. I mean, they average 16 turnovers a game. So, I mean, they're probably going to have right around that 16 to 20 turnover number on most nights. So they really need that to kind of flip for this game to keep it around that, you know, maybe 12 number. I think they're at 10 against Virginia Tech, which that was really, really good. And that allowed them to win that game, obviously. As far as stifling Juju, I mean, you're going to have to throw a lot of bodies at her. You're going to have to change up looks and put different people on her if she starts getting into a rhythm. She's a really good player, and I don't think you're going to be able to take her completely out of the game. What you do need to do is take everyone else out of the game. And I think that starts by rebounding the basketball and really closing out on three-point shooters. USC shoots the ball pretty well. Offensively, I just think Baylor's going to have to move the ball, and they're going to have to get an effort like they got from Jada Walker in this last game, you know, from someone. Someone's going to have a blow-up game where they score 25-plus points. Points in my eyes for them to win this game. Maybe it's Jada Walker. Maybe it's Sarah Andrews. We'll find out, but I think they're going to need that, and they're going to need to shoot the basketball well.
All right, so that wraps us up here with the mailbag questions for this week. Thanks to GMAC and BUGrad21 and Scotty B and Doc Crow, Useless Kim Degree, Bears 224, and Master Pierce, MPH. Appreciate all of you for filling up the mailbag this week. And for those who haven't done so but would like to, just look for Grayson's post each week on Monday when he puts it up to ask questions and get yours in, and we'll get to them as best as we possibly can. But anything before we head on out here?
No, I'll have insider notes today from practice, so keep an eye on that, and on Thursday as well. So keep an eye on that on the premium side of things. Outside of that, tons of recruiting, still quite a bit of basketball. Ashley just had an amazing post this morning that I don't think anyone would want to miss. So just keep an eye on that if you're a premium subscriber, if you want to be.
Like I've said 100 times on the show already, over on the boards, a lot of basketball discussion, the freshman versus veterans debate, and the strategy moving forward, and just kind of picking up the pieces and reexamining them post a round of 32 loss for Scott Drew and the Baylor men. Also a lot of talk about the women in the Sweet 16, and of course plenty of spring football. So head on over if you're a Baylor fan or just somebody maybe interested in the Big 12 or college football as a whole. A lot to digest over on Sikkim365.com. But until next time, next week, Tuesday at 11:15 is where you can always find us. Thanks to Garrett Ross behind the scenes. And thanks to Grayson Grunhaver. I'm Craig Smoke, and this has been the Bearcast on Sikkim365.com.